Hi, this is Craig Valentine, host of Early to Rise Radio. Have you ever wanted to become wealthier, healthier, wiser, or just have more time to appreciate the finer things in life? On this show, we reveal what high performers are doing every day to be more successful without sacrificing their personal lives. Early to Rise Radio is sponsored by the Perfect Day Formula. Get your free copy of this game-changing success guide at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's get started with today's show. On December 2nd, 1990, a friend of mine made a huge mistake, and she ended up in a very, very bad situation. But she didn't let that stop her. Today, despite being confined to a wheelchair, she is one of the most powerful speakers you will ever hear from. And she has her rituals of resilience to share with you today. In addition to her stories about how she became a magical speaker and can help anybody who's nervous about stepping on stage to become a great speaker. I want you to get to know my friend, Stacey Copez from Australia, who I met years ago and who I've even traveled to Australia to work with. And today she is a speaker about resilience and a coach on rituals of resilience that are going to help us get through these crazy times. So let's go meet Stacey. Her and I share a very common bond around music that helped her get through her dark days. And her advice today will help you get through anything. Stacey, welcome back to the show. This is going to be a lot of fun.
I am so looking forward to this.
This is really going to be great. So you're down in Sydney, Australia today?
I am. Definitely a great part of the world to be in at the moment.
Oh, very good. Very good. So why don't we go back, way back in time. You have been on the show before and you've told your story. But for new listeners, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're at now, and what happened earlier in your life that has led to you, being where we are today?
Yeah, so if we're looking at where I'm at this moment in time, I'm the founder of the Academy of Resilience and author of How to Be Resilient, the blueprint for getting results when things don't go to plan. So I'm seen as an expert in the resilience space. And for me, that's come about not through your typical path. I think a lot of people that speak about resilience have come from, an academic or a psychology background, but that's definitely hasn't been my path. And the way I became, my story as far as resilience goes is, if we go way back in time, 30 years ago this year, and I was 12 years old at the time, and I was cooling off in a relative's backyard swimming pool with my younger brother, who was 10, and a couple of other boys around the same age. And as I did every time I visited this relative's pool, for me, the most fun thing to do was just to keep climbing up on the edge of the pool and diving in. And this was a pool that definitely was not designed for doing that. It was only an above ground pool, so it wasn't deep. And so I just kept climbing up on the edge and diving in, and it didn't go unnoticed. I was getting yelled at to stop, but I think we can all sort of remember what it's like to be 12 and bulletproof and invincible. So I just completely ignored those warnings. Instead, I was a bit of a perfectionist, and I was thinking that I was splashing too much as I was diving into the pool. So I stood there, stood on the edge of the pool for a moment, and I thought, how can I make a perfect dive without splashing? So I thought that if I was to try and keep my feet together and hold my legs straight, in theory, I thought that would make a really clean entry into the pool. So I took a deep breath and I did exactly that. And it felt like any other dive that I'd done before, until I went to try and swim up, to the surface, and I realized I couldn't move. So I didn't feel any pain. I didn't feel like anything had gone wrong. I was completely conscious, holding my breath, panicking, desperately thinking, how can I get the attention of my brother to help me, which I couldn't do. So I held my breath for as long as I could, but then when I couldn't hold it any longer, I just had to give in. And as I gave in and I breathed in and my lungs filled with water, I blacked out. And eventually they realised something was wrong, because they thought I was just mucking around, and raised the alarm for help. And it wasn't until later that night at the third hospital that I got taken to that a doctor came and told me in intensive care that I'd actually broken my neck and drowned, and that I'd never walk again. So that felt like, in that moment, I literally felt like my life was over, because prior to having that accident, academically I was on fire, and all I wanted to do from even before I started school was to be a vet. And I was just at the end of my primary schooling here, and I'd gotten into a selective agricultural college for my secondary schooling. So, you know, I was on track there, and I was an athlete. So I was a pitcher in a softball team in the summer. I was one of the first two girls to ever play soccer for my school, like over 30 years ago. And I was a rep runner from every distance to the, you know, 100 metres to the cross country. So being told that I'd never walk again was like, it felt like a death sentence to me at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. When on earth, you know, so I mean, back then you didn't think about being resilient. When on earth did you even hear about resiliency for the first time? And, you know, when did, you know, speaking about resilience even come to be a thing?
It's interesting in that I never used the word resilience. I never thought, it was never a word that was on my radar until it was actually 2011. So this is like, and what's that, 21 years later that I'd been doing quite a lot of personal development work, and yeah, started working with coaches and mentors just to try and, you know, work out where I was going to, what I was going to do, you know, from sort of where I was at, because I just had jobs and I hadn't really done anything that had really felt that it fired me up. Mm-hmm. And it was through learning to do some speaking, and I was never going to talk about my own story, because growing up in Australia, we've got the tall poppy thing is rife here, and I thought everyone would think I was a total wanker for talking about myself. Yeah. And thankfully, a mentor at the time said, look, Stace, it's not about you, it's about your audience, and, you know, you got to get over yourself, and if you don't share your story, you're being selfish. And I'm like, well, hang on, how can I argue with that one? Mm-hmm. And so I was working with another mentor just to really flesh out, well, you know, what's the hook with my story? What's the theme? What's the takeaway? And it was, you know, working with her that she actually put the label of resilience, and she said it's just a perfect fit. You know, if you reverse engineer how you turned your life around from, you know, not, you know, being told you'd never walk again and feeling like your life was over, to having done some really, I'd done some pretty incredible things, and I'd just come back from volunteering in the Solomon Islands as a mentor over there, and, you know, really, really horrific conditions over there. And I'd run for parliament. I did all these crazy things. I wanted to make a difference, but I just didn't know how. So, mm-hmm. you know, I ran for two levels of government. I just did lots of different things. And at the time, I was investing in property. I was doing all this stuff, but I just didn't really think that there was much, you know, anything special about me. I had what I called little old me syndrome back then. It was like, oh, nothing to see here, moving right along. And then I was, you know, I eventually shared a 5-minute version of my story on stage at a big event, and I was just blown away by, you know, I had people laughing and crying in 5 minutes, and for the next 2 days of the event was just inundated with people going, oh my God, that was just so, you know, so powerful. And there was, you know, an amazing, you know, speaker, Alan Pease, was in the audience that day I spoke, and I had a chat with him. I wanted to get a photo with him, of all things. I was a big fan of his, and he said he'd seen me speak and was asking if I was speaking professionally at the time. And I said, hell no, that's the first time I've ever done that. Wow. And, he pulled up a chair and spent 10 minutes with me, and he told me all the great things that I'd done in that time. And he just said, look, but you know, having a story is one thing, he goes, but it's only going to get you so far, a good story, he goes, but if you can teach using your story, he said, then, you know, you're basically set. And so it was that conversation was really the clincher for me to help me realise that if I could then tie, you know, a theme or a topic and teach and speak, then I was onto something. And, you know, that was 9 years ago, and 8.5 years ago I left my last job and, you know, started my business and just, you know, pursued speaking and teaching resilience ever since then. So it was, as often is the case, we often have people around us that see something in us before we see it in ourselves, and that was definitely the case for me.
Got it. So let's go in between those two points, right? You're told that you're paralyzed in that by that doctor in that hospital. And then, you know, 15, 20 years later, you're speaking on stage. Let's go through the first year after. And how did you start to become resilient in that time when, you know, I couldn't imagine much harder of a thing for someone to go through?
Yeah, when I look back on it, I think for me it was probably just survival in the beginning. If I look at how I was then, I definitely wouldn't say I was exceptionally resilient at the time. I ended up for the first 3 years especially, I was pretty angry. I was angry, I was resentful, I was bitter. All of that stuff was directed at myself because I was in this situation because of my own actions, but I didn't want to talk about it with anybody, and I was pretty good at just going, nothing, you know, nothing to see here, getting on with life. And, you know, I really internalized that. And my outlets at the time for, you know, those first few years was I spent a lot of time drunk and stoned, even though I was only, you know, sort of just turned 13 after, just not long after I'd left hospital. So, yeah, I spent a lot of time drunk and stoned, and they were my outlets. And, you know, for the first few years, I would have given anything either to have not taken that dive or to, you know, not be, you know, even be here at all. And, you know, it was just in the last year I spent a lot of time reflecting on it and trying to really capture, like, how to describe what it was like at that time. And what I've realized is that, you know, while physically I drowned once, I was in a situation there where I was emotionally drowning every single day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it took a few years in the depths of the darkness, very much alone in that. But what I found was what really kept me alive at that point in time. I found music was my outlet.
I was just going to say, you and I grew up in the same era and loved the same music, and we kind of have a little kinship about, you know, some of the rock music from the 90s. So, you know, keep on going there, but I love it when you comment on my stories when I put some of that 90s music in there.
Absolutely. Your soundtrack. So, yeah, we were definitely kindred spirits in the musical front there. And I was super fortunate to be at the lowest point in my life at the height of grunge.
Exactly.
You know, it was like the 90s rock, the 90s grunge was like the angstiest, angriest, perfect soundtrack to my life at the time. And I found that music, I didn't really give it the credit it deserved until probably in the last year or so. And I realized that music gave me a way to express myself that I didn't have the words to do. Mm-hmm. Energetically, it was amazing. Then I started going to gigs, and then there was that sense of community and belonging, connection and energy that came from that. And I really lived gig to gig through my teens, and even now, like, music is just such a huge part of my life. Mm-hmm. So they were the things that really kept me going and then eventually got me out of, you know, some of those more destructive habits. And I really just got on with life and, you know, got, you know, finished school, got jobs, had relationships, did all the really normal stuff. And I think that was when I sort of started to go, well, you know, really, okay, I can't walk. There's a lot of things I can't do. But, you know, if you focus on what you can do, then, you know, that made a huge difference. And I just changed the way I looked at what happened. I mean, I couldn't change what had happened, but I could change the way I felt about it, and I could change what I did next.
So the very first time you go on stage, what are you thinking as you go up there, and what did you tell the audience? You know, I once saw Sean Stevenson, who has since unfortunately passed away, but he was, you know, he was born with handicap, and he actually became one of the world's greatest speakers. And he said, when you go up on stage, you want to make them laugh, make them cry, and change their lives. And I saw him do this in 10 minutes, and it sounds like you did it in 5 minutes. So what the heck did you say?
Yeah. Oh, first of all, I was absolutely terrified. I was absolutely terrified because, again, I thought that everyone would think I was, you know, a total dick for talking about myself. And I did.
You Australians.
I know, aren't we terrible? And I think, and then being a woman as well, there's that extra element of having those doubts about talking about yourself. So all I did was I thought, okay, what can I do here? And it was like, I had 5 minutes. So I thought, I just tell the 5-minute version of my story. So, and I took, you know, people back to where I was at, you know, the point in my life that before the accident, I talked about the accident, you know, injected some humor into that. And then I sort of shared.
What would that be? Because, you know, I think to everybody on the outside, like, oh my goodness, how could there be humor in this? But that is where the greatest humor comes, is from, you know, the unexpected. So what did you say? Because you're such a great speaker that I almost want to kind of make this a double lesson for everybody that, yeah, we're going to learn resilience, but we're also going to learn some of your magic speaking powers too.
Oh, thank you. The bit I did share in that was I talked about how it was a wonder I hadn't actually broken my neck earlier, because I talked about how I was such, you know, such a gifted athlete, and how I, you know, from athletics, I represented my school at pretty much every track and field event except for high jump. And the story I told is how awkward my technique was for high jump, and I was very tall. Like by the time I was 11, I was already 5'6". So, you know, now, you know, if I was on my feet, I'm about 6'1".
Wow.
Yeah, no, I hide it well. And, yeah. And so, but I talked about how my awful technique was head first, and how many times when I was doing high jump, I actually cleared the mats completely and I literally went head first into the crowd. Wow. On the other side of the mat. So, and it was like, well, it was a wonder I didn't do myself some mischief earlier than this.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was that kind of thing that just did that. And then, so taking them from that, yeah, from the emotional low, like, so just giving them those peaks and troughs, because I think that's the biggest thing with speaking, is you need to take people on a journey, and you need to, you know, you need to pick them up, you need to take them down. And, but if you keep things static the whole way through, then, you know, really there's nothing in that. And then I had sort of mentioned that, you know, even how I got to go to that event, because it was a very high ticket event, had to, you know, obviously pay our way to be there. And then we got the opportunity to speak on that stage. And I'd sort of said that I'd shared that I'd gotten engaged, you know, I think it was like a month or two earlier. And I said that I went there instead of getting an engagement ring. So yeah. There was those type of things. And like I said, there's other decisions that we make when you look at it when you look back on things and you look at some of those decisions we make, where I think if we want to really put ourselves out there, and particularly, you know, in entrepreneurship, there's some of the sacrifices that we make that a lot of our non-entrepreneur peers think are crazy. Like, you know, wow, you got engaged and you didn't get a ring because you wanted to go to this event. I'm like, absolutely. And I wouldn't have changed a thing about it.
Mm-hmm. So it's almost like when you speak, you take people on your hero's journey. But as your one mentor said, that, you know, that's all fine for entertainment, but you want to teach something. So why don't you keep taking us through that journey of how you refined your presentation over time, and how then you brought in resilience as the message?
Yeah, it was really, I think there's no substitute for just getting the reps in. And so what I did was, you know, I started with that 5-minute talk, and then with that event that I spoke at, it was actually like those 5-minute talks. I think there's about 20 of us that did that over the course of a couple of days. And the winner got a half hour spot at a bigger event that organizer was running. And I ended up tying for first with that. So I knew that I had a big gig coming up a few months later, and I had a half hour spot at a multi-day event. So I worked with my mentor going, okay, well, how do I then take this 5-minute version of a talk into a half hour talk? And so she was the one that helped me to then, first of all, put the word resilience, and then to then go, okay, well, you need to reverse engineer what were the key things that you did to turn your life from the lowest to the lowest to where I was at that time. So what I started to do is I just spent a lot of time reflecting, journaling. I actually wasn't a journaler before then. And I started journaling just to start to really capture, well, what did I do? Because I think so much of our times is we just go through and we just do things, but we don't consciously take the time to capture what we're actually doing in the moment. So I looked at it and I'm like, okay, well, how did I turn it around? And so then I started to sort of look at, well, what were the key themes? So, you know, just a couple to give you an example, you know, the first thing I did was I took complete responsibility for my experience in life. You know, got rid of the excuses, didn't blame anybody else, didn't blame the world. I made sure I had good people around me, so I had great support. And I was able to actually then put together a framework that then used, you know, the word resilient for the nine key themes. And then I tested that through putting out an ebook. And then I pretty much, my ebook was my keynote. So it was like I was really leveraging the content in as many different forms as I could. And then it was just getting in front of audiences, so getting the reps in, getting feedback, and then just refining it, seeing what worked, what didn't work, and, you know, then working with my mentor each time and going back and going, okay, this is what seemed to land, this is what didn't. I recorded, like video recorded and audio recorded every single gig that I could, and then I sat there and watched it back, as uncomfortable as it was.
Well, I've heard that U2 still watches their concerts. You know, when they were doing concerts, they would watch the concert the next day, and it's the iteration and refinement over and over and over and over and over again that leads them to becoming the best in the world.
Yeah, and it's I hadn't really thought about it in this way. It's just sort of landed with me now. It's no different than being an elite athlete and then watching your game or your race back over. Just to see where are those little tiny one percenters that you can do to just refine. And with speaking, it's like what you do is you go, okay, well, what's that little 1% that I can change next time? And just doing things like with such little increments, because sometimes people can go, I'll just go and try and do something completely different, but then you never know which bit lands and which bit doesn't. It's also having, you know, people go with you and really keep an eye on the audience, and really to sometimes I think also to video in the audience so you can really see where, you know, is there a common point in the talk where people are drifting away attention-wise? Is there something in the talk where you guarantee get a laugh every single time? So it's constant, meticulous attention to the detail, and then trying new things, and then, you know, you constantly then evolve from that point in time.
What have you learned? So, I mean, what I've learned in my own presentations is, you know, naturally I come out at a very low energy, and I you know, making that change was one of the biggest things. How does Stacey come out on stage, and, you know, where do you start in the story? Do you start in the middle of the story with the drama, or what is it that you do that really hooks people in? And what are some of the other things that you've seen from other great speakers along, you know, your times off to the side of the stage watching the next speaker in front of you?
Yeah, a lot of it depends on the event and the style of event. I think when you're doing some of those big stages and the more multi-speaker events and stuff like that, then that's where music becomes really, really powerful as far as your entrance and stuff like that. And I think that probably my most favorite event that I've done where I felt that, you know, I come on stage with the most power, even though I was the most nervous, because this was a couple of years ago, and it was actually the same person's stage where I first shared my story.
Oh, wow.
So I went from there to then headlining his event, you know, his 2-day event. And so I opened the Sunday morning. So I was on stage at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning. And the AV guy said to me beforehand, and he said, oh, yeah, what song do you want played as you go out on stage? And I thought, oh, I hadn't really thought about it. Yeah. And so I said, oh, you know, something that's quite rocky, as in, like, you know, love my rock. Yeah. And he goes, what, like Eye of the Tiger? And I'm like, no, but now you mention it, the rocky theme would be amazing.
It would be perfect, absolutely.
Yeah, so I was so nervous side stage. I was actually really sick as well. So it was like, you know, trying not to cough and doing all those sort of things. And then as soon as that Rocky theme come on, you know, you can't help but even now I'm thinking about it, I'm kind of like bouncing in my seat. And so I went on and then shadow boxed with the, you know, with the host and did all that sort of stuff. And that was awesome. And, you know, the audience were up on their feet, which is unusual for an Australian crowd.
Sure. Unless you're at an Aussie rules game.
Yeah, that's it, perhaps, depending on who's playing. And but, yeah, so to be like, because Australian audiences are just so reserved, like, yeah, they don't get on their feet for much. And so that was a really good high energy one to do. So up until the last 12 months, I started my speech with, you know, a few questions, get some hands up, doing all that sort of stuff. But when I was actually in Toronto last year, when I was in Toronto last year, I actually met my current speaking mentor at an event I was at, and he offered to help me. You know, Nick Morgan, he is just brilliant as far as speaking. And so we've been working together for 12 months. And one of the first things he got me to do was to share a video of one of my keynotes so he could just completely tear it apart.
Yeah.
And it was actually, I thought it was going to be worse, but the one key thing he did was he changed the order of how I tell my story. So now the first thing that I share is the day of my accident. So the first thing I do is I go, you know, it was the 2nd of December, 1990. That's my opening line.
Yeah.
And it just brings everyone straight in. Although I did have a little bit of an issue when I was trying to start with that opening line being the music, you know, I say I'm a human jukebox now, because every time I kept saying something or other, it was 1990, all I could think of was Iggy Pop and Candy. It was a rainy afternoon in 1990, and it took me about 3 days to get past that.
So then... quick thing before we move on to the resilience side of thing and you know, the content of your speeches, but to everybody listening who has to step on stage and is terrified or even do a Zoom presentation, what is it that, you know, worked for you at the beginning when you were nervous? What is it that you still may do today to anchor yourself? What have you seen other speakers do to loosen up? Because it sounds like, you know, when you play that Rocky and you do the shadow boxing, like all of a sudden that makes the whole presentation a whole lot easier because it kind of, you know, cuts through the tension. But if you know, when you're going and speaking in front of some of these corporate audiences, and maybe when you were just getting started in this business of speaking, what were you doing to settle the nerves?
There's two things that I do now. I guess the first, but before that, though, I used to share, I still get nervous.
Mm-hmm.
I still get really nervous. I still have the stuff that goes on in my head before a gig, the day before, even sometimes if I'm on the way to an event going, oh, I hope they cancel it. Like that stuff still goes on. Like it never goes away. You just get better at dealing with it. So first of all is just to acknowledge the nerves are just so real. And I think I've only ever come across one speaker who says they don't get nervous. And he's just a freak. So, but the nerves are real. So there's two things that I do. So the first thing I do is I have a quiet moment before I go on, and even just when I'm getting the nerves kick in the day before, and I close my eyes and I visualize one person in the audience, and I picture where they're at in their life, and I picture the struggles that they're having. And I know that I need to show up in my absolute best in order to serve that person, to know that if I don't do my best and give them everything I've got, that their life would be worse off for it.
Got it.
And there's that deep sense of moral responsibility that comes with that, and to be of service. And then it's not about me. It's got nothing to do with me. It's all about how can I be of service. So that's a big one. Beforehand, if obviously different setups, you know, if I'm not visible to the audience before I go on stage, I literally play the Rocky theme in my head and I bounce and I shake and I just try and dispel some of that nervous energy. And that really helps just to, it's literally like what a boxer is like when they're going out, you know, jumping up and down and doing the shakes. I do that. And then the moment I get on stage, it's so quick now that no one would ever know that I'm doing it. But what I do is I take a second and I project my energy into the ground. I project my energy up. I project my energy all the way around the back of the room and then bring it back to me. Wow. So it sounds really woo-woo, but for me, my biggest priority with speaking is connection. So for me, it's connection over content. So if I sometimes, because people go, oh, I might forget something. You know, if I forget something, they don't know that I forgot it, but my priority is all about connection. And it comes back to that, you know, the Maya Angelou quote is like, people, you know, may forget what you said, they may forget what you did, but they'll never forget how you made them feel. So that's always my priority. It's all about what sense of connection can I give the audience? And that's absolutely my priority. And I feel it. And then when you're in a room, obviously it's a lot different when you were online. And I have found that adjustment really difficult to make. But when you're in a room and, you know, you just try and make eye contact with as many people, and you'll get a few people that just give you so much energy and so much love back. And so if you're sort of getting a bit, you're feeling a little bit of doubt, then you just go back to those people. I've heard them called the lighthouses in the audience, and you just go back and you just get the energy from them as well. So it's so much of it is about energy. It's energy and presence and being really grounded in the moment.
I love that so much. So now let's focus on the content of that presentation where you're helping people become resilient, because, oh my goodness, this year and who the people listening in the future, this time has taken so much out of so many people. And we're actually, you know, probably not even halfway through this at the time of recording things. There's so much more of this pandemic to deal with. How are you helping people now more than ever with this message of resilience, and what's really connecting with people?
Yeah, it's been quite interesting from the resilience perspective. And I know that, see, you being my coach, at the very beginning of it, I did get a little bit excited going, oh, wow, this is exciting. There's like resilience. It's the time for this. And I'm really grateful that you did stop me in my tracks at the time and go, it's too soon. It's too early. And people are in panic. And the resilience stuff will come later. So what I did in the beginning was I just made sure that I encouraged people to stay connected. Because I did take particular exception to the languaging. I still hate the languaging around social distancing, mm-hmm. because it's really what they're trying to say is physical distancing, but social connectedness is more important than ever, particularly when people are isolated. So I really encourage people to stay connected. And what I did for the first 3 to 4 months of the pandemic is I wasn't really sure how I could best be of service, because I was used to 95% of my work being on stage in rooms full of people, which wasn't possible anymore. Mm-hmm. So what I did was I opened what I called a virtual drop-in centre.
Oh, and that's
right. Yeah, so I shared that across all of my socials and I said, okay, my virtual drop-in centre, which was just my Zoom room, I said is open for half an hour every day. And you know, some days you'd get a group of people, some days there might not be anyone turn up. But I showed up every single day. And then for another couple of months, I just did weekdays. And then I sort of realized, I thought, you know, it was kind of fizzling out. So I just I stopped doing that. But there were some really great conversations that were there. And I just made it known that I was available, mm-hmm. because I really wasn't sure in the beginning how I was going to change my business, because I knew it was going to be a long time before I was going to be on a stage again. So I sat back and I observed for a long time and I thought, okay, let's just do a lot of listening. and also paying attention to how I felt and how I was coping with it. And I think, like a lot of people, I helped people. I just, you know, a lot of the time I just shared how I was dealing with it and letting people know that it was really normal to have these wild pendulum swings from being quite excited about having some time and space to be at home, and particularly if it's with people with families, or just the time and space to create, and then going back to this other end of the pendulum and going, oh my God, I feel so restless and overwhelmed, you know, F it all, I'm not going to do a single thing.
Yeah.
So I think it was helping just to normalize it. Organically, I ended up starting to do a bit of coaching because I wasn't doing any one-on-one work. I hadn't done any one-on-one work for a long time prior to this. So it was just, yeah, showing up as a coach, sharing content, particularly really reinforcing the element of being connected, and also recognizing that there was definitely a process of grief that people went through with all of this, because it was a grief and a loss of life as we knew it. I think it was also recognizing, helping people recognize that potentially a lot of people had become very, very complacent, that the way their lives were, with the way they were always going to be. Mm-hmm. I found that my own personal story probably became a little bit more relevant and a little bit more real to people, because the pandemic had shown people what it was like to have your life completely changed in an instant and having no control over it. So, yeah, there was a...
For yourself in your own story, did you ever study the five stages of grief, and did you ever track how you personally went through them in your life?
I didn't. And it was only probably in the last year or so that I even became aware of the five stages of grief.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. See, it's really, for me, it's been quite interesting in that I probably just did things, I said, unconsciously, and didn't really know that I was doing them. And, you know, I wasn't working with, you know, psychologists and stuff. I had really had some pretty shitty experiences with, you know, psychologists and social workers early on in my life. So I just sort of felt that, you know, I just do things my way. Realizing it probably, you know, being the lone wolf was not, you know, in the long run, not healthy. It got me so far, then, you know, I was able to share those things and encourage other people not to be the lone wolf that I was.
So when, let's say somebody listening to this was to get coaching with Stacey, and you know, they're coming in and they, you know, they had a great job and a great life, and you know, their kids were happy at school, and all of a sudden, you know, middle of March 2020, job goes away. Now they're homeschooling kids, and maybe their kids are back in school, and but they're not back at work, and maybe they're working a little bit remotely. But you know, end of 2020 is entirely different than what they thought it was going to be and what it was a year ago, and they have no idea what it's going to look like in a year from now. Where do you start the conversation with somebody? How do you enter that conversation in their head to start building their resilience? And then we can get into some of your rituals of resilience, which are key for everyone.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing is just really to allow people the space to be heard. Because I think that a lot of people probably aren't having the conversations, or they're not sharing exactly what their experience has been, because particularly, you know, for those who, you know, with their families and stuff like that, they don't want to burden anybody else, because everyone's struggling in their own way. So for me, I think the main thing to begin with from a coach's perspective is just to listen, and really just to say, look, tell me what it's been like for you. And, you know, listen without judgment, ask further questions where they're needed. But then once we've got to that point, then it's starting to go, well, what's actually been great about this? What have you learned? What have you been able to do that you wouldn't have been able to do had things had been the way they were? Starting to give some perspective. Also, I'm finding that the overwhelming uncertainty is probably the thing that people are struggling with the most, because so many people are just sitting back almost waiting for it to all be over. rather than taking action and keeping on moving. So, you know, we're in the ultra marathon of all my ultra marathons, yeah, you know, with no finish line in sight. So a big part of what I do is shifting people's perspective of uncertainty, because really most people, when the word uncertainty comes up, there's a negative connection to it. There's a real negative energy around it. Whereas I like to flip it and go, really, if nothing is certain, then you really have a blank canvas, don't you? So if nothing is certain, then anything is possible. And really giving them a different lens on the situation, rather than going, well, nothing's certain, I can't do anything. It's like, well, you could do anything and you could do everything. So I find that that's a huge shift. And the other one is just coming back to gratitude. And, you know, really when people look at it, I've heard it said, particularly with this whole pandemic, is ultimately a lot of people have, as a collective, we've actually gotten what we asked for, because so many people were going, oh, I wish I could spend more time at home. I'm not going to spend enough time with my family. You know, I've always wanted to work on this project. I hate that I have to commute so much. I hate that I have to travel. You know, I really don't like this stuff. I don't like the people in my office. And ultimately,
I'll tell you about the travel. I mean, I ain't going anywhere for a long time, because I'm like, I like staying home.
Yeah, and that's a big thing for me too, Craig. It's like, because I traveled so much as well, and I've actually loved it. Like yesterday, I did a virtual keynote for Hewlett Packard, and I didn't leave my room, and it was amazing. Wow. Whereas typically to do an event like that, I would have had to have probably, you know, flown to Melbourne or done something like that. It's like, well, I was done in half an hour and then I was on with my day. And, you know, normally it would be, I would be away for at least a day to do a half hour gig. And here I was, it was great. So I think that's the thing is the travel's been a big one. The commute has been huge. So it's just really, it's helping people with getting people to see, well, what is the good in it? And that's always the question, because people always sort of focus on the negative. But if you actually get people to flip it and ask, well, what's the best thing about this situation? What surprised me? What have I learned? What have I had the opportunity to do that I wouldn't have done otherwise? So, you know, so much of what I do is helping people see that obstacles and uncertainty and challenge and change and adversity are most amazing opportunities and gifts if you look at them the right way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I totally love that. And, you know, so then, Stacey, with the resilience and helping people get through this, you've developed the rituals. And, you know, I love rituals. I mean, they just anchor me so much. So are there like, you know, how many rituals do you teach in a presentation? Are there like 10 or 3 or what are they? Are there generic ones? Or do you just have specific ones? Like, how does it all work there?
So what I find is when I'm doing a presentation, like if you're doing, you know, a 30-minute to a 60-minute presentation, is yeah, sticking with the rule of three. Because I think the tendency for many speakers and presenters and experts is to try and give too much, to try and squeeze in so much content. And it comes from a place of great intention. It comes from a place of generosity and wanting to over-deliver. But the reality is that the more you give people, the more overwhelmed they get and the less likely it is that they're going to do anything with what you actually shared. So I always stick with the rule of three. And at the moment, like the rituals, so for instance, the session I did yesterday, so the three rituals that I shared for me, I shared music as a ritual. And so as part of that, what I did was I got the audience to choose a song that they can use as their go-to to fire them up. The group I spoke to were mainly in sales. So I'm like, okay, what's that song that you can use before your sales calls just to get you really fired up and moving? And so, and I have a playlist that I sort of use as a shuffle play, and I do that every morning. I do it before calls. I do it, you know, when my energy is low, just, and I move with it, you know, whether you jump, whether you dance, whether you do any of those things. It's just whether you sing. It's just getting your vibrations higher, and then also then getting them to choose a song to ground them and chill out as well. So I use the
what do you listen to?
As for the upper or the downer?
Both of them.
Yeah. Oh, for me, my uppers are, I use a lot of rock, but also too, I have some, you know, daggy disco in there as well.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I think there's, and, you know, some Pointer Sisters or some Hot Chocolate and, you know, some of that, Rick Astley. There's all those things that are the kind of the daggy stuff that, you know, and really you just dance because no one is watching. So it's doing that. And then some of the chill out stuff, then, you know, I have a mixture of stuff, even like as far as chilled as Enya. Mm-hmm. But, you know, sometimes it can be, you know, I love Counting Crows and some of their really chill stuff, bit of Jeff Buckley. I keep adding to the playlist. So I've got a playlist on Spotify called Chill Out. I've also got one for morning movement sessions, and I've also got a playlist called Resilience Rocks, which is the, you know, the really pump up, but it's all rock music. Yeah. So I use those. The other ritual that I shared, I share is gratitude as a ritual. And, you know, I have a very different perspective on gratitude. Because I find that for the most part, gratitude is taught as write down three things you're grateful for each day.
Yeah.
And I personally found it a little bit wanky and found it didn't work for me because it kind of felt like it was an obligation rather than something that I genuinely had invested in and put my heart into.
Uh-huh.
So I use mantras instead because ultimately all it, the intention's the same. It's to experience a feeling of gratitude. And I find that by using a mantra, it's simple, it's repeatable, which is very ritualistic. And it's something that, you know, takes 10 to 15 seconds to do. And, you know, it's very low barrier. You can do it anywhere, anytime. So I shared gratitude as a ritual, and also was the third one I shared? I shared three things yesterday. It'll come back to me, but there was, you know, there was three. Journaling. Journaling was the other one. So journaling's a massive, massive ritual for me. I haven't missed a night of journaling in over 5 years now.
Mm.
And just transformational, you know, started just to capture what was the best thing that happened in the day, because again, we get what we focus on. So if you start to train your brain to look for the positive and the bright spots in situations, and you'll see more of them. And so it started as that. And then some nights I end up writing 2,500 words if I'm really, really in flow. Yeah, some crazy stuff comes out.
By pen and paper?
No, I do it electronically.
Oh, okay. I was going to say that your hand would be all cramped up.
Pretty much, but the typing fingers get a bit numb. But, and even last night in my journaling process, I was writing these things, and then I'm like, and I actually wrote out to myself, I'm like, wow, I just think I've just found another exercise I can use with my clients just through my journaling. So, yeah, so that's just three simple ones. But I think, yeah, if we're looking at it from a speaker perspective, stick with three. Go deeper on three, and then I always encourage my audience to choose one thing to do, recognizing if you try and do everything, you do nothing, just encouraging people just to pick the one thing. And then I generally get them to, you know, to share it with me depending on the format. So at the moment, being virtual, I usually get people to email me, you know, to a specific email address I've set up just for people that have either heard an interview or been on a webinar. And then I will say, well, then I'll send you a copy of my audiobook if you send me the one thing that you're going to do differently. And it's a bit of market research as well there, just to see what resonated with people, what they chose to do. And I've also found, like even yesterday's session, you know, I had 10 emails within 5 minutes from people in that room, you know, in the Zoom room, sharing what they're going to do, but also sharing quite a bit about their own personal stories and their own challenges, which is, you know, it's quite vulnerable of them to do that. But I learned so much in the process too.
That's absolutely amazing. I love how you continue to grow and change and learn. So what is your vision, Stacey? What do you want to continue to do, and who do you want to move going forward?
Yeah, for me, I've realized that I've being able to distill it down into that I would love to see a world where obstacles are seen as opportunities. That's my approach to life is anytime that there's a barrier, it's like, how can I flip that around? And I've really loved being able to share that with people. And that inspires me now is that I feel that it's probably, you know, one of my superpowers. And particularly in the environment that we're in at the moment where unfortunately I think that so many people just see obstacles everywhere. And particularly for those that are plugged into the news 24/7.
Oh my God,
it's so draining. But you know, for those that are plugged into the news and all they see is obstacles, all they see is fear, all they see is what is wrong. And I just feel that at the moment, so many people have just outsourced their responsibility and they've outsourced the decision-making for their life to the media and the government. And I just find myself getting really frustrated when I see that. And so I think for me, coming back to that vision, I just want people to actually take ownership of their lives. You know, the entitlement mentality is probably my sort of mortal enemy. And so for me, I look at the opportunities in the obstacles, and also like my personal approach to life is that I'm grateful for everything and I'm entitled to nothing.
That's really, really beautiful and profound. And I agree with you, and I can't wait for you to continue to have that impact that you deserve to have. And I hope so many people listening to this, you know, if you have a podcast to get Stacey on, and if you're part of a big company to have Stacey speak to your people. And if you feel like Stacey's a voice and coach that you need to get you through some tough times, then certainly reach out to Stacey. Which leads us to the question, Stacey, where is the best place for people to connect with you on social media and through the internet?
Yeah, as far as social media goes, I'm most active on Instagram and LinkedIn, but I'm also accessible on all of the others, and it's very useful having a name that is very rare, so I'm very easy to find. And also I manage all of my own social media and my emails. So if you do reach out, you're going to get me directly. I absolutely welcome any questions, any comments, any feedback. I really enjoy the conversations that come from someone listening to an interview such as this.
Well, I'll tell you what, this hour flew by. And,
didn't it just?
Yeah. It was amazing to hear your story again and to see the evolution and to hear all those speaking tips, which I selfishly was asking about for myself. So, Stacey, thank you so much for all of this. I really appreciate it. And is your book still available for people as well?
Yeah. So the first book, which it's been 5 years now since I actually released that, and I'm actually starting work on the next one now. But yeah, the book, How to Be Resilient, if anyone would like to get a free copy of the ebook, then howtoberesilient.com.au. But it's also available as a hard copy on all good bookstores, online and offline.
Awesome. Absolutely love it. Thank you so much, Stacey. Really, really appreciate it. I can't encourage people enough to follow you, to learn from you, to hear from you, and to reach out to you to get help through these interesting times and to get stronger and more resilient. So thank you so much. And I can't wait to see you again in person someday soon.
Absolutely. Someday soon.
Yeah. Thank you, Stacey.
Thanks, Craig.
What an incredible episode. Stacey is absolutely amazing. Make sure to pick up her book, follow her on social media, and listen, if you are going through tough times, please, please check her out and maybe even invest in her coaching to help you, just like she's invested in coaching with me to help her grow her business. Now, if you want to learn more from me, go over to craigballantyne.com and also send me a message on Instagram at @realcraigballantyne and let me know what you thought of today's show, where I kind of shut up and let somebody else give great advice. And I really, really enjoyed it, and I hope you did too. We'll talk soon.